I'm JG Michael, and this is Parallax Views. Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. Before we get to this edition of the show, I just want to promote Wall Street Window, a website maintained by Mike Swanson that provides valuable insights on both financial markets and geopolitics. It's been around since 2003, and its slogan is "Be in the Know," and I highly recommend it as daily reading. So go on over to wallstreetwindow.com and keep yourself informed. This edition of Parallax Views is brought to you by the $10 and above tier supporters of Parallax Views on Patreon. So, with that in mind, producers credit shoutouts to Gunner, Mark, Alexander, Catherine, Tilo, Emilia, Jeff, John, Bert, Brian, Elliot, Michael, Brace, Nick,
Meresham,
Galen, Arlen, Beau, Gigadelic Media, Chance, Chase, Dan,
David H, Y Kellerman, Sade 13,
Kathleen, David,
Ava,
Bob,
The West Bank Robbery Podcast,
Jamie,
Enoch,
Gary,
Max,
Ishtofer, James, Martin, Matthew Ho,
Brian,
Nobody, Thomas, and Dano. And now on to the show.
Hey there, Parallax News listeners. On this edition of the program, we're going to be talking movies with Jim DiEugenio of the website Kennedy's and King. Jim is perhaps best known as a JFK assassination researcher, and he even has a new book out on the subject, The JFK Assassination Chokeholds. But he is also someone that's very interested in cinema. In fact, at one point, he was a film critic, and until recently, he wrote movie reviews for Consortium News. In any case, Jim has a lot to say about not only the state of cinema, but also the state of film criticism, and that's going to be the main topic of our conversation as we look at the death of film criticism and what Jim refers to as the infantilization of cinema. So, with all that being said, let's get right to it with Jim DiEugenio.
Welcome back to Parallax News, a guest that I always enjoy having on. It's been a while. Usually we talk about the assassinations of the 60s with this guest. He is a researcher into the Kennedy assassination, the MLK assassination, RFK, and he runs the website Kennedy's and King. Welcome back to the show, Jim DiEugenio. And you've had a lot going on lately. I think you have a new JFK book out, right?
Yes, it's called the JFK Assassination Chokeholds. Okay, that's that came out about 2 or 3 months ago, and that's co-written with four other authors, three of them who are attorneys. Okay, and I think that came out quite well. It's an anthology. I contributed 2 or 3 essays to that.
So what I wanted to have you on to talk about on this episode was, you're known for your work on the Kennedy assassination and the assassinations of the 60s, but you've also done a lot of work in regards to film criticism. And, you know, recently I've been having more discussions with people about the state of film criticism. And I've often argued that I think film criticism is dead in a lot of ways, or the old style of film criticism has been dead for a while, you know, and it's been replaced by, I think, people that just do reviews of movies, and they're not doing the type of criticism we saw in the past. We'll get into your views on film criticism, but maybe you can give your background and how you got into being a film critic.
I used a long, long time ago. I'm talking like the late 1970s. I started off in the field of film criticism for my local newspaper, a small town, Erie, Pennsylvania. And I did that for a couple of years. And then I moved out to California and I went to film school at Cal State Northridge. Okay. And I got a bachelor's in film production. Okay. Now, that gave me a real good background in how films are made, because most critics, I agree with you. There aren't any film critics, they're reviewers, you know, but they have no idea how pictures are made. All right. And so that gave me a good background on how you make movies. And I had to make a couple of films, you know, to graduate from film school. Now, about 12 years ago, I started reviewing films for the late Robert Perry site, Consortium News. And I started reviewing politically or socially oriented films. I think the first film I reviewed was Clint Eastwood's J. Edgar. Okay, that was the first one. All right. And then the last one I reviewed was Oppenheimer. Okay. And then I told you the other day, I decided to resign over my review of Killers of the Flower Moon. And I decided to go ahead and set up a Substack site. So if you want to see my review of that very disappointing movie, Killers of the Flower Moon, you just go to my Substack site and you can read it there. Okay, so that's my bat. But let me add something about this. See, back then when I first got started in this, back in the 70s, I had assimilated a lot. See, if you grew up back then and you were interested in films, okay, you had to be exposed to this incredible array, what is usually called the golden age of film criticisms in America. Okay, at one time when I was growing up, and I don't even know if your listeners are going to recognize these names, you know, although they should if they're very interested in films. At one time in that era, you had John Simon, Andrew Saris, Stanley Kaufman, Vernon Young, Pauline Kael, okay, and I think I'm missing one.
Dwight McDonald.
How could I forget him? Oh, my God. Slap me. Okay. And Dwight McDonald. You had those six people all reviewing films at the same time, which is unbelievable. And in fact, I just did an Amazon review for Dwight McDonald's book on movies last night. Okay. Because it was reissued for whatever reason. All right. And I said, you won't see criticism like this any place in America today. Okay. Dwight McDonald was a very powerful intellectual figure in both politics and the arts from the 30s to the 60s. His review of Fellini's 8½ in this book is an absolute classic. It's one of the best film criticisms you will ever see any place, written by an American. Okay. And it was, by the way, his review of 8½ is one of the finest pieces of film criticism you're ever going to see any place.
What,
okay.
For listeners that are unfamiliar, like, what made that specific review stand out to you?
Because he understood the movie. You know, he really got himself in. When you see the review by Pauline Kael, or when you see the review by John Simon, you can tell they didn't understand the picture. They didn't understand the picture. McDonald got right into what the movie was about. And by the way, I have to say, there was an anthology book, I think, called The 200 Nights of 8½ that was published later. And you, Fellini was interviewed for that book, and you could see that McDonald was absolutely right about what he was trying to do. Okay. See, there's three, as McDonald said, there's three kinds of reality in this movie. Okay. There's Fellini's real life. Okay. There's his past life, his memories, and then there's his fantasy world. Okay. And the movie goes between all, you never really know which part you're in until you're in it. Okay. You know, and it transfers itself so smoothly. They're like a hydraulic transmission. Okay. And you, and it's very, at the same time that it's entertaining, it's funny and it's gripping at the same time. And then comes that absolutely incredible ending. And if you haven't seen the movie, I think the ending is on YouTube, but just take a look at the ending of that movie. It's an absolute stunner. Okay. How he ends the picture with all these people, you know, in costume, you know, dressed up like the people from his past. And he's the circus leader with the wand directing them. Okay. It's an absolute triumph. Well, McDonald's review was the only review I found at that time that really understood. Well, I don't know how about you. I think 8.5 is one of the 10 best pictures ever made. Okay. It really understood what the movie was about, you know, and that's what you're looking for, is for the critic to understand what the movie is about. And Dwight McDonald could write. Okay. I can't stress that enough, because if you can't make yourself understood, and if you can't do it with eloquence or humor, you know, or some kind of rapport with the audience to make them know that you really understand what the heck you're talking about, then you're not really writing effective criticism. So he could write, and on top of that, he had a very broad background in the arts, okay? Going back, I think he started writing film criticism back in the 30s. Now, that's called the goal. Now, I'm not going to say that there wasn't any film criticism before that. There was. You had people like Harry Allen Potampkin, you know, who wrote film criticism, I think, in the 30s. Edmund Wilson wrote some criticism, okay? The first guy to be really recognized as a film critic in America was James Agee, okay? And Agee, there's a two-volume set that you can buy. It's called Agee on Film, okay? And I think the first one is his movie reviews. I think the second one are his scripts. He wrote the script for a very interesting picture called Night of the Hunter.
Okay, I love that movie.
With Robert Mitchum, probably his best performance, along with Cape Fear, okay? But that's a very, very good movie. Okay. And he wrote the script for that. All right. Then he wrote for Time and The Nation. And as Dwight McDonald writes, you can really tell the difference, okay, in that compendium, because the ones he wrote for The Nation, he was obviously given a lot more freedom in both link and ability to express himself, whereas Time, he was caught in the Henry Luce's loose press, okay? So then Agee really, I believe, set a standard, okay? You had other people like Manny Farber and Robert Warshaw, but Robert Warshaw was more of a sociological critic. See, what you had with these six people, except not Pauline Kael that much and not Simon that much, because they were more intellectual critics, okay? And in fact, that's a big shortcoming, I believe, with Pauline Kael.
Okay. Oh, really? Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Because, well, come on. Anybody who can look at 8.5 and not see the aesthetic triumph that Fellini had done in that movie, or anybody who can look at Citizen Kane and somehow not understand what the heck Orson Welles and Greg Toland have done. I mean, in my opinion, what Welles did in Citizen Kane is he took the art of film direction to a point that no American has passed since, and very, very few, if any, have matched. And if you can miss that with a completeness that she did, you know, that says that you're not really an aesthetic critic. You're really an intellectual critic. Okay. Simon was, I wouldn't say, well, Simon was almost as bad in that respect. Okay. But not quite to the point that Cale was. But see, somebody like McDonald or Andrew Saris, in fact, Saris wrote, I don't know if you're aware of this, I believe his best piece of film criticism was Citizen Kane, the American Baroque, which was like a 10-page essay in which he really got to the heart of that movie, and he took on some of the critics of the film. You know, and so Vernon Young was also very good at this. Vernon Young was so good on Antonioni, you know, in comparing his style. See, and that's, and I guess I should stop for a minute. See, Antonioni and these other directors I'm talking about, what they did was develop a style for films, okay, which most Hollywood pictures don't have, okay? You know, Antonioni had this style that you could you wouldn't even know that it's, you could walk into the movie late, okay, and be in the middle of nowhere, and you could tell it's his movie because he's the only one who directed movies like that.
That's how I felt when I first saw, when I was in film school, when I first saw Blow Up, this 1966 movie. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. See, Blow Up was, if you haven't seen Blow Up was such an incredible picture. Okay. The ending to that movie, you know, which I'm sure you remember, on the tennis court, you know, with the clowns coming in and then faking they're playing tennis and then the ball goes away. And Hemmings actually gets sucked in, retrieves the ball, and then you get the great overhead shot, okay, of him disappearing into the landscape. See, that's communicating with the art of film, with the style of the movie, you know? And the great sequence, I'm sure you're familiar with this, when it's almost like he's developing the Zapruder film. Okay, and he's blowing it up and blowing it up and blowing the film up until he finally thinks he sees something in the trees. Okay, you know, and that's an incredible moment of film. Okay, when you see that sequence, you know, it really draws the viewer into the dilemma that the protagonist has, and see that film. Stanley Kaufman wrote a very good review of that film. I think it's about 10 pages long. A Year Would Blow Up Some Notes. Okay. And Cale, like she usually did, and this is what's so incredible about Pauline Cale. In my opinion, you could make a pretty good list of the greatest movies ever made with the films that she panned. Okay. She panned Lawrence of Arabia. She panned Bergman's Persona.
So we're back after some technical difficulties on this edition of Parallax Views, where we're discussing film criticism and its golden age with Jim DiEugenio. And before our technical difficulties, we were discussing Pauline Kael and her approach to film criticism and how oftentimes she was very critical of some of the greatest films out there, so much so that Jim said, you know, you could make a list of the greatest films based on the ones she snubbed.
and I'm, by the way, that's not an exaggeration at all. All right. Okay. Some of those films that she didn't like, you know, I would not mind submitting them, you know, to an all-time top 10 list at all. You know, like Lenate, Blow Up, Persona, okay. If you can believe it, Lawrence of Arabia. All right, 8.5. You know, it's see, Kale, like Andrew Saras, had a kind of predilection for American movies. All right. And she became famous because of her famous, what was it, 15,000 word review of Bonnie and Clyde, okay, in the New Yorker, which she started off famously by saying, "What do you have to do to make a good movie in this country without getting your head chopped off?" All right, something like that. That's what she started off, and that's the movie that got Bosley Crowther fired. Okay, he was the film critic for the New York Times for 28 years or something like that, and then he panned Bonnie and Clyde. Kale came out with that review in the New Yorker. Then it got on the cover of Time magazine. Bonnie and Clyde made the cover of Time magazine, and then that's when Crowther made his exit, from the New York Times as far as being its film critic. But see, this was something else about Pauline Kael. She liked picking fights with other critics, and it didn't really matter if they were good critics or bad critics. She liked picking fights with, like, Dwight McDonald. She used to like to pick fights with him,
She was a
and
bit of a
I don't have
firebrand.
to, yeah, I don't have to say about Andrew Saras because they were like two pigs in the mud, okay? But she liked doing this kind of stuff. She liked being provocative. She li and she I think she found it as a way of drawing attention to herself, okay, which she most notably did. Now, I think, like I said this in the early part. See, Kale was essentially an intellectual critic, all right, sort of like John Simon was, all right. By the way, he just recently died. He was the last of those people that we named, as being sort of like the Hallmark Hall of Fame of the 1960s. He passed away like a year or so ago. He was the last of them, all right. And her and Simon were kind of intellectual critics, whereas somebody like Dwight McDonald or Stanley Kaufman or Vernon Young, they and Andrew Saras, of course, and in fact, Saras was really the father of what they call the auteur theory. The auteur theory, in case some of your listeners don't know, this was an idea that Saras borrowed from the French, the so-called French auteur critics, Francois Truffaut and Jean-Luc Godard. Their godfather was André Bazin, all right? And they thought that film was too often an actor's medium or a spoken word medium. And they didn't think that style or the way a film was put together was getting enough attention. All right. And so Truffaut and Godard started this Politics des Auteurs, which Saras brought over and made it his own. Okay. And this is why Saras. See, this is why Saras was so preferential to directors like Hitchcock and Preminger, all right? Because he thought that they exalted a style, over their film. Well, there's no doubt that Hitchcock was an important stylist. The question about Hitchcock, though, was what about his stories and what about the acting in his movies? I mean, who would ever think that Tippi Hedren, this model that he saw on TV, could be the new Grace Kelly, but anyway, so this is where people like Dwight McDonald and Saras got into arguments when Saras praised the birds, okay, and he thought it was such a great picture, you know. And then and Dwight McDonald wrote a column in reply called "Adventures in Birdwatching." Okay. And he said words of the effect, you know, "I wouldn't mind arguing with about this point, but just show me where in the birds there is a triumph of style." Okay. You know, I just don't see it. I see a lot of special effects. Okay. You know, but anyway, I just don't see a triumph of style. But see, the thing is, the fact that me and you are talking about this now, the way we're talking about it, this shows you just how far down, you know, film criticism has become. All right. Because in my opinion, you know, there's nobody on the horizon or past the horizon, you know, today that qualifies as really being a film critic. And I guess we should differentiate.
Yeah, what is the difference in your view between a movie reviewer and a film critic? Yeah.
Okay, that's a good question. I'm glad you brought up. Okay, a film reviewer to me is somebody who's there to like take the menu. Okay, you know, describe the menu to you. Okay, this is what's out there. You might want to see this. You might want to see this. This is like this. This is an adventure story. Okay, this is a romantic comedy. Okay, all right. This is a animated feature. All right. He describes the movie. He says, this is what's good about it. This is what I didn't like. Is it worth seeing or not? Okay. And it's all over in about 500 words. Okay. See, a film critic, at least my idea of a film critic, is somebody who you can actually learn something from. Okay. And he can broaden your perspective on what films should really be like and what certain faults are and certain attributes are. And then he changes the way you look at a movie the next time you go. All right. And, you know, and at the very best, at their very best, what a film critic can do is show you what makes film an art form. All right. And on top of that, he can show you the art that's there. All right. You know, in other words, this is what makes this film so good. And this is what you can learn from this movie. And this is how you can expand your own perceptions of both life and film, okay, by what I'm showing you in this picture. All right. That, to me, that's the very best kind of film criticism. All right. You know, and I guess, you know, this is why I believe that Blow Up created, and again, we're going back to what, 1966? Most of your listeners probably weren't even alive back then. All right.
It's a great film, though. Everyone should see. I mean, it's mandatory viewing for anyone into film.
See, this is why there was such a battle over Blow Up when it came out, okay? Because that actually was a hit, okay? That, if you can believe it, an Antonioni movie that was actually a hit, okay? And people were really puzzled by it because it was so different, okay, in its style, all right, from not just the normal kind of films you would see, but also from his previous films. You know, his previous films have been kind of slow paced, okay, and character driven, all right? Whereas Blow Up really had kind of a fast pace to it, and it was really a mystery story, all right? And there's the famous, again, I feel like I'm describing something out of a museum, but there's the very famous last sequence. There's two very famous sequences in the film. There's the one where he is in his studio. He's a photographer. And he keeps on, from what the title comes from, he keeps on blowing up a picture. Okay. Because he thinks he sees something in it. All right. Okay. And he blows it up and he blows it up. And finally, there what seems to be what is discerned as a body lying on the grass. Okay. That sequence, which it's, which Antonioni, that he masterfully edited that, okay, was so incredibly interesting. Okay, because here you have a film actually delving into the mysteries of photography, okay, for the first time. Then, of course, there's the even more famous last scene.
Right, we talked about that earlier before the
Right.
tech difficulties. Yeah.
And the very last shot is extremely overhead, okay, and then he disappears from the frame. All right. And that to me, when you see it again, all right, is a perfect metaphor for that movie. All right. Like, here is a guy trying to find an answer to a mystery, and he can't find it to the point where he gets erased out of the picture. Okay. And so this is why this created so much controversy. I mean, how many movies do that anymore?
They don't.
All right. And I would agree with that. There just aren't very many films, and I guess it's ironic that we're doing it on Oscar night. Okay, that we're doing this show on Oscar night. Okay. Although I did give Oppenheimer a pretty good review for Consortium News. Okay. I usually don't like his movies, Christopher
Nolan.
Nolan.
Yeah.
I just don't like his films, And Interstellar, I didn't like. Tenet, I thought was a joke. Okay. I guess his Batman movies weren't bad. Okay. With Christian Bale. All right. But Oppenheimer actually was a respectable film. Okay, which I give him credit for that. And from what I understand, it just won the Oscar for Best Picture. So, see, and I guess this relates to another point. How can you really have film criticism in the age of the Marvel Universe? Yeah.
Well, now, Jim, there's even things like this whole phenomenon called instead of TikTok, it's called movie talk, but it's like TOK movie talk, like TikTok, and it's influencers trying to sell you the film now on seeing it. They're basically doing advertisement rather than criticism.
I've never heard of it. What is it?
It's basically like a TikTok for movies, but it's not criticism at all. It's just influencers being paid to tell you to watch the movies. I mean, it's not, it's literally studios are paying online influencers to tell you to see these certain movies. I mean, it's not, there's no like deep dive criticism of the movies this way. It's like short little 30-second videos and whatnot. It's horrifying.
And they have an internet channel over this on
Yes.
YouTube.
Yeah. It's on the social media site TikTok. Talk. I mean, it's a little film community, but it's not, it's so surface based. There's no like deep dive criticism. It's just like little videos and
Wow.
influencers. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So that's what's happened. And by the way, and I'm going to say something that's probably going to be unpopular with some people, but in my opinion, the beginning of the end was Siskel and Ebert at the movies.
Let's
That.
talk about that because I don't entirely disagree with you on that. I have a little bit of criticism of Ebert, but.
If you remember, these were two Chicago film critics. One was from one newspaper, one was from the other. Roger Ebert was kind of the short, stocky guy. Gene Siskel was kind of the tall, gangly guy. All right. And they started this syndicated TV series, What was it called? At the movies, I think at the beginning. Yeah. All right. It was at, or sneak previews or whatever. Okay. I think it was at the movies and a change of sneak previews. And they would go ahead and line up. It was a half an hour show. Okay. And they would line up three or four pictures. All right. And then one guy would give his opinion and the other guy would give his opinion. Okay. And then they would end it with thumbs up or thumbs down. Okay. And this, and oh, by the way, it wasn't just that, but they would also include like a 2-minute excerpt from whatever their movie was under discussion. All right. So if you go ahead and figure it out, if you're going to do three or four movies in a half an hour and you take out the credits, you know, from the beginning and the end, okay, and whatever, you might have a commercial or something, you know, and then you show three excerpts for a total of 6 minutes. Okay, how much in-depth criticism can you get into in 4 or 5 minutes? You know, and the answer is you can't. And then when you end the segment with thumbs up or thumbs down, what does that tell the reader, you know, the listener rather? To me, you know what that show did? What that show did was give you the subliminal message that, hey, if they can do it, anybody can do it, because
Right.
that's how cavalier the treatment was. You know, it wasn't like you having to go ahead and sit down at a kitchen table and read, you know, Dwight McDonald's, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 word review of Eight and a Half, you know, getting inside the movie as much as anybody could possibly. It wasn't that at all, you know, expanding your horizons or anything like that, or showing how stylistically, you know, Bergman or Fellini pulled off a set. It wasn't any of that at all. Okay. It was simply like a supermarket opinion. Like you would talk, or, you know, outside of Ralph's, you know, we have out here, you know, outside of Ralph's, I think you have Publix in Florida. Okay. You know, as you're emptying your shopping cart, you know, and the thing is, it was a huge hit. You know, At the Movies was a huge hit. It went on for decades. First, Siskel passed away, then
And then it
Ebert
was
passed away.
right. There was Ebert and Siskel, and then Ebert and Roper. Yeah.
Okay. And I think it's still going. I don't know who's on it now.
Right.
Okay. But, and in my opinion, that was really the beginning of the end of serious film criticism in the United States. Okay.
Just because you couldn't really, you can't analyze a film in 6 minutes with an excerpt and two guys
No,
talking about it for 2 minutes, you know?
no, 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 not at all. You know, and then you had slowly but surely each one of those film critics I talked about, you know, either passed away, or I think Cale had some kind of disease that she couldn't write anymore. Okay, and so she retired. All right. I think Andrew Sarris eventually got fired from the Village Voice. He went to the Observer. Okay. And then he passed away. You know, John Simon, there really wasn't anywhere for him to go. Okay. You know, he tried to hang on for a while. Okay. You know, and Stanley Kaufman passed away. All right. So, you know, and
It's
then
become a
last year,
lost art, you know.
well, yeah, in the last year, Stanley Kaufman, he was kind of ill. He was very irregular at the New Republic. All right. And so there, see, if you don't have any models, okay, and that's what they were, all right, then it's very hard, you know, to put together what film criticism really should be, you know. And, you know, it's really, I believe, the combination of this kind of corruption of what the art of film criticism is, plus the advance of DC and Marvel to
Well,
the
not
point.
just that, not to interrupt you, but it's also a matter of like, now you have these reviews that come out that are really just like press releases, and people can't tell the difference, you know?
You know, it used to be, you know how bad this has gotten? It used to be that when a studio took a car to Judith Crist, Judith Crist was a film critic for the, I think, the New York Post. When they took a car to pick up Judith Crist to take her to a screening, everybody screamed about it. Everybody screamed about it. You should not be doing that. You should not let the studio give you a ride to a screening of their movie. You know, now today, this has gotten so endemic, you know, with all these press junkets and, you know, blurbs, you know, the rise of the blurb. You know, I swear to God, some of these people write their reviews so they can be blurbed, you know, in a movie ad, you know. And then what you just told me about this movie talk thing, I mean, God, you know, so how can there be any really serious film criticism in the United States?
The
I mean,
thing that gets me, Jim, is, and I just want to give my personal experience with film criticism, and then I'll let you talk a little bit more about this, is you know, people have said to me, well, film criticism is about saying whether a movie is good or bad. And I'm like, no, it should be much more than that. You know, I was really influenced by Pauline Kael, specifically her critique of Sam Peckinpah's Straw Dogs, because, you know, I found that movie, you know, very fascinating when I was like going to film school and whatnot. And her critique of it, she gives it a lot of high marks, but then she also calls it a fascist work of art, and she's kind of disturbed by that. It wasn't just a critique that said, oh, this movie is good or bad. It was kind of this meditation on the film itself and what disquieted her about it. And it wasn't just about, oh, this movie is good or this movie is bad. And I think the best film criticism isn't just about, oh, you should see this movie or you shouldn't. It really places the movie into a broader context, if that makes sense.
see, a long time ago, Dwight MacDonald wrote that it's not really the evaluation that's important. What's really important is the analysis and the exemplification of why, okay, you think something is particularly distinctive in a film. See, Sam Peckinpah was a lightning rod, okay. If you know, and there's nobody around like that anymore at all, even close, because what Sam Peckinpah did in his greatest film, I don't think there's any question about this, his Western, The Wild Bunch. You know what he did in that film was he, and I don't mind saying this at all because I don't think it's an exaggeration. He revolutionized the whole genre of film with The Wild Bunch, you know, because what he did there in both the opening scene and the closing scene is he brought to bear on those two shootouts at the beginning and the end of the film a revolutionary style that had never been done before in any kind of sustained way. All right. I mean, you did have like a slow motion ending to Bonnie and Clyde. All right. I think Kurosawa was the first guy to do it in Seven Samurai. But what Peckinpah did, he did this for 4.5 minutes at the end of The Wild Bunch. He intermixed, I think he had six cameras going at one time at different speeds and different angles, so that you would see somebody's death spiral in about three different ways in about something like 2 seconds. Okay. And he did that throughout the whole scene. And it got people really angry. You know, what are you doing? Why are you glorifying somebody getting shot? And to me, he wasn't glorifying it. What he was doing was poeticizing it. You know, he was turning it into an art form. And the triumph of the Wild Bunch. And this, and again, it's hard to understand this unless you've seen the movie, is that at the end of the movie, he has you feeling sorry for a bunch of thieves and killers.
Right.
And you're actually sad that they died, you know, and you're wondering, oh my God, what am I thinking? But that's what he did with that movie. It was a combination of the characterizations that he went into, plus that revolutionary style. And by the way, that's been imitated many times, okay, ever since. Nobody's ever to come even close to it, all right? And I have to say something else. About every week or two, I jump on YouTube and I take a look at that again, the climactic shootout from The Wild Bunch. Because, you know, just to see the way he did it, okay, and how he kept everything in his head. Anyway, that movie created an uproar, okay, because of, you know, people were saying, you know, Sam, what are you doing? Why are you trying to glorify this bunch of gangsters and killers, okay, you know, and turning it into something poetic, you know? And this is how Peckinpah got his reputation, as being the bad boy of Hollywood, you know? Do you know what Peckinpah said about Kale in her review of Straw Dogs?
I do not know about that.
Oh, he responded to it.
Okay.
Okay. He said, sorry to giggle about this, but he said, Pauline Kael was cracking walnuts with her ass, okay, in that review. He said, words effect, look, you get hired to do a job, and I had to adapt this piece of crap book, okay, that had one good scene in it. You know, this attack on the farmhouse at the end, all right? And you try and do the very best that you can. In that movie, I was a prostitute, okay? I was doing what they hired me to do so I could get a job, okay? So that's what he said, you know, about her review, all right? And by the way, I see Peckinpah, that movie, Straw Dogs, I think if you compare, and I've seen it more than once, you know, it wasn't him at anywhere near his best, okay? Where I believe, you know, his best movies are Ride the High Country, The Wild Bunch, The Getaway, okay? I think those are Peckinpah's best movies. And by the way, I'm sure you're aware of this, you know, they cut a lot out of The Wild Bunch during its premiere that he was very angry about. And it wasn't restored until many, many years later. Right. Okay. But the thing is, you know, the Western genre has been more or less negated by the rise of the comic book movies.
That's true.
You know, the Western used to be a very big genre in American films. Okay, it's not anymore because of the rise of the Marvel Universe plus DC, you know? And this all goes back to the success of the first Spider-Man movie, you know, because that's what essentially brought the Marvel Universe, you know, into films. You had DC with Superman before, okay? You know, and the Superman 1 and 2 did very well.
And that's what established the Tim Burton Batman. Yeah.
Right. The Tim Burton Batman established that one. Okay. You know, and it's created the infantilization of the American movie industry. You know, see, people, if you weren't around back then, when Bonnie and Clyde came out in 1967, you know, it created a real controversy.
It shocked people.
Yeah.
It shocked
right.
people.
Yeah. And some people didn't know how to react, you know, to this combination of comedy and tragedy, you know, people getting shot in the face, you know, and et cetera, you know, and it created a real back and forth, a discussion about where are movies headed? What is this? Because, in Bonnie and Clyde, you had this violence. Okay. Remember, this is 67. I think the Wild Bunch is 69. Okay. You had this really incredible violent scenes. In fact, I think the critic from Newsweek says words of the effect like, in Bonnie and Clyde, blood and dirt gets stirred around like the Battle of Verdun in World War I. Okay, because it was so shocking to see that at the time, and it was really a milestone in American films. Okay, and Arthur Penn used to talk about how he had to fight with the censors, okay, to get some of the picture, into theaters, but the thing is, it was a hit. Bonnie and Clyde was a hit, and so that created a whole new frontier, I believe, of both films and film criticism at that time. Unfortunately, it didn't last very long,
Right. And well, by the way, my point in bringing up Kill's critique of Straw Dogs, or with critiques that exist of Bonnie and Clyde from other critics, is whether you agreed or disagreed with any of the critics we talked about, they created discussion, and I don't think we have that kind of discussion about film today. I think we just have, people say, oh, I like the special effects in the Marvel movie. And that's a sad thing to me.
And you know something? I hate to say this, but I agree, and it's been that way for quite a while. It's created, a kind of mindlessness, that results, I believe, in not just poor films, but a poor audience. Okay. And if you can't exchange an intelligent opinion, then I believe, movie going becomes a very empty experience. And I truly believe that it's become the combination of, the infantilization of the content, plus the fact that nobody's out there right now, who can really intelligently talk about movies, lead a discussion, and in my opinion, there's nobody out there who's even giving accurate descriptions of what's in the movie. See, let me explain. Vernon Young was a critic for Hudson Review and The New Leader. And he wrote two interesting books on the cinema. One was about Ingmar Bergman. I think that was called Cinema Borealis. And then there was one on film, Unpopular Essays on a Popular Art. And what Vernon Young could do as well as anybody and better than most is that he could describe a movie, to make you see it, with words, all right? And
He could make you picture it in your mind's eye.
Exactly correct. And his two most famous ones on that, well, actually, his most famous one on that was The Passion of Joan of Arc. Okay. He made you see the film scene by scene, character by character. Okay, sequence by sequence. And at the same time he's describing it, he's making you understand what's going on in the picture. Okay. And he did that throughout that whole review. Okay. All right. There really isn't, in that review, there really isn't any evaluation at all. The evaluation is built into his description. Okay. And nobody does that anymore. Nobody even comes close to doing something like that anymore. But that is how he communicated to you, how film can be an art form. Okay. Through its imagery, And remember, Passion of Joan of Arc is a silent film. You know, all right, there's very little printed dialogue on the screen, you know. But he may, and I don't want to make it feel like he was dated, but he would do the same thing with Antonioni. He would describe a sequence to you and show you, like, for instance, in his review of La Ventura, Antonioni's first part of his trilogy. Okay. He describes a scene where the couple who are supposed to be looking for the protagonist's lost girlfriend, okay, who has disappeared, okay, they drive off, okay, and then they turn and disappear, okay, in the car. And he says, but what nobody notices is this. As they disappear, the camera creeps forward. Okay, meaning that they're not looking for her anymore. Something is looking for them. Okay, you know, and this is the kind of subtlety, okay, he would bring, and he would make you understand, you know, just what the movie was about and how the director was forming his ideas. See, nobody does that anymore, you know, and not even close. You know, and so I believe, you know, that, and I don't know if you agree with me on this, but who's worth reading?
Right.
What reviewer or critic is worth reading today?
I can't think of many that I would actually spend the time to read. I mean, now most of them are doing, you know, video reviews on YouTube, but it's all, I mean, my issue, and I don't know if you'd agree with this, but my issue is I'm not saying that these superhero movies and stuff like the Marvel movies can't exist. The problem is that I think we've gotten to a point. And people like William Friedkin, Scorsese, Coppola have talked about this for the past 2 decades. It's getting harder for filmmakers to make movies for grown-ups because what's in demand are just these superhero movies. And with that, we also have seen the decline of film criticism. We've seen the, I think, the decline of audience participation in discussing these movies. And it's just people almost, I think, don't want to see movies for grown-ups anymore. And that to me is very scary. I mean, escapist cinema is fine, but it shouldn't be the only thing that exists. And that's what bothers me about the climate today.
I think there's a lot of truth to that, you know, that everybody is out to create the new blockbuster franchise, okay? And so, I mean, first you had Superman, then you had Batman, okay? Now you have Black Panther, okay? You know, and they have created these huge franchises. All right, that are almost impossible to lose money on because you have this built-in audience. Oh, I forgot the Avengers. Okay, you know, there's also that one, you know. And if a studio grabs onto one of those things, you know, Spielberg said, remember, Steven Spielberg has kind of become passé now, the guy who revolutionized Hollywood himself. Okay. You know, and he said, you know, these things are $200 million. Okay. And on top of that, you've got to throw $75 million in for advertising. All
Right.
right. So, you know, they're going to be booked in 4,000 theaters because the studio wants to get its money back. And that edges out everything else. And I'm glad you brought this up even more because, see, back in the 60s and the 70s, there was what they called an art house circuit. Okay. And in case you don't know what I'm talking about, an art house circuit was a kind of chain of smaller theaters, you know, like maybe 200 seats, 300 seats. Okay. And you would have maybe three or four of these in every major city. In New York, you would have more. In New York, you would probably have about 15 or 16 of them. Okay, because there was more people in New York City who are willing to go to those kind of foreign films, you know? And you could play an Ingmar Bergman movie, okay, throughout the country at these art house circuits, all right? Or you might be able to show an Antonioni movie, you know, throughout the country. And it would get exposure, all right? See, when I first came to LA, that was still around, but that's pretty much gone now. I think the only thing you have left is something called the Lemley, which is maybe five theaters, okay, in a city the size of LA, you know, 8 million people, all right? And what's even worse is the revival houses are gone in LA. Again, when I first came, there were like maybe six of them, and I would get the schedules for all of them, you know, and they Buster Keaton Film Festival, okay, Sergei Eisenstein's Potemkin in October, you know, okay, and I would get them all, and I would drive all around the city, you know. Well, today there's one. Today there's one, and I agree. I believe it's the comic book movies that have shoved out, you know, this kind of an audience. It just doesn't exist anymore, you know. And for all, well, I shouldn't say it doesn't exist, but for all intents and purposes, it doesn't exist anymore, you know. And like Dwight McDonald once said, if you don't have that kind of access, A, how can movies innovate? And B, how can the audience widen its horizons if you don't? You know, if everything is like mainstream Hollywood, all right, then how on earth does the audience ever discover anything else that can be different? You know, and the answer to that question for Dwight McDonald, of course, was it can't. Okay. And by the way, let me say something about why he wrote that. If you remember, like I said earlier, Antonioni had a trilogy of films, La Ventura, La Notte, and L'Eclipse. All right. Now, those films were all very daring and different. Okay. But at the end of L'Eclipse, he did something really revolutionary. The main characters are gone, played by Alain Delon and Monica Vitti. All right. What he did, though, is he put together, of all things, a montage. Okay. And I think it lasts about 6 minutes. All right. And everybody was kind of shocked by this because the major characters weren't in it. But at the very end of the montage, he ends with a scene of where they were supposed to meet with nobody there. Okay. And the distributors, even at the art house theaters, they chopped it off the end of the movie. And so Dwight McDonald heard about this and he went to the theater and he wrote a letter of complaint against the manager, you know, moaning and complaining. How dare you do this? You know, this guy is an artist and you're manipulating and chopping off his work. How do you ever expect your audience to learn anything, you know, to be challenged, to have their horizons widened when you do stuff like this, you know? Just because the Alain Delon and Monica Vitti aren't in it, that doesn't mean the movie has to be over, you know? And so, you know, and so so we've gone from that to where there are no foreign films anymore of distinction, you know, playing in any of the major cities anymore. You know, it just doesn't happen, you know. And see, what was so important about that, about having the art house circuit alive and well, is that it was like a pressure gauge on Hollywood, you know, that, you know, Rock Hudson and Doris Day, they're all right. Send Me No Flowers or Lover Come Back, okay. Whatever you want to call those movies, what they were. I didn't think they were very funny myself, and I didn't think Doris Day or Rock Hudson were very good actors either. Okay. But how can you keep on putting this out time after time after time again when you have these foreign films that everybody is talking about, that everybody wants to see because they're so different, and they're so challenging. And they can really open up what the cinema can be and do, and so this was a constant pressure, on the Hollywood mega studios to go ahead and make something different,
And to be
to make
innovative.
so, right, exactly, and so without that, without then Marvel and DC can sort, like there's like a herd of horses galloping, in on the Great Plains. There's no end in sight. Then there really isn't any end in sight to this, and it's really funny that of all people, Steven Spielberg should say something about this because many people believe that the big sea change was when Jaws and Star Wars came out. Okay. When those two films came out, I think within a year of each other. All right. And that began the whole saturation booking. Maybe I should explain what that is. See, many, many, many years ago, hardly ever happens anymore. They would open a prestige movie in like New York, LA, and Chicago, and they would give it 2 weeks to get a really good word of mouth and some good reviews. And then they would then go ahead and slowly break it out, to like, say, for example, the first week, 500 theaters. And then after that, 1,000, and maybe after that, 2,000, and then they would book it in everything they could. Well, see, when that doesn't really exist anymore in any substantial way. Now, with these huge $200 million pictures, you have to make your money back from the very beginning. Okay. All right. And let me explain a technical reason why that is so. In the first week a movie is out, the studio gets 90%. The distributor gets 10%. Excuse me, the theater circuit chain gets 10%. So, in other words, they make their very most money from the very beginning. It then goes down to 80, 20, 70, 30. Then by about the end of the first month, it's 50-50. Okay. So if you're going to put out a $200 million picture, you want to book it into 4,000 theaters and you want to mega advertise the first week so you can maximize your income. Whereas if a movie only costs 20 million, you can afford to do the showcase thing that I'm talking about. Because you can 20 million is not a lot of money in the movie industry. Okay, it's a drop in the bucket, really. Okay, so they can afford to do that kind of tier, what they call a tiered release. All right, you hardly get that anymore. Very, very, very seldom. And it's really, because I believe, and I know some of your listeners probably won't believe this, but there are some good people in the movie business who want to make good pictures. And I'm not saying there's a lot of them, okay? But I'm saying there are some people who want to do good pictures, And I think that as this phenomenon, this infantilization of American pictures, has galloped along, I think that they've just more or less kind of thrown in a towel, you know, that
I've
they're.
got to ask, not to interrupt you, but have you ever talked to Ollie Stone about this? I know you've worked with him. I mean, does he
I've
have
ever
a gauge
talked
on
to
that?
Oliver?
Well, just about the state of film. Does he sort of.
Well, see, Oliver is a kind of, see, Oliver is the exception to the rule.
Okay.
Okay. Because, you know, because he made it big with Platoon, okay, you know, that got four Oscars. I think he won Best Director for that. And it did something like 140 million. Okay. You know, he still has some cachet in Hollywood. Okay. And he's represented by a very high level agent.
Right.
Okay. He's at CAA, you know, which is one of the, what they call the big three. You know, there's William Morris, there's the CAA, and there's ICM. Okay. And so he can actually, let's put it this way. If you read some of the things this guy writes, did you see him go after John Wick
Yes, yeah.
on Twitter? Okay. And Keanu Reeves specifically. You know, he says there's about 100 shootings in this, and not one of them has any credibility at all. Okay. Sometimes, you know, I feel like emailing and say, Oliver, please, you're biting the hand that feeds you. Okay.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that because I've seen that with there was a controversy recently over this YouTube movie reviewer named Chris Stuckman. And recently he got into making his own films. So now when he does his movie review thing on YouTube, he'll say, I only want to celebrate, you know, movies. I don't want to give negative reviews anymore because he thinks if he criticizes movies coming out in Hollywood now, while he's trying to get into the business of movie making himself, that he won't be able to get jobs. Is people in
Oh
Hollywood will
my
resent him for it.
God.
I mean, but
Oh
that
Jesus.
it has gotten to that point where, you know, I know people that are very worried about the biting the hand that feeds them in Hollywood. You know, I think Ollie Stone just doesn't care, but you know.
Wow, that's really something, you know. But you know, if you ask me, even the so-called serious films aren't really that distinguished. You know, many, many years ago, and again, I'm showing my age. You know, but many, many years ago, you would have, say, a Sunset Boulevard,
Right. Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
which is really a good picture in a lot of different ways, you know. And it's a serious film that I believe still stands up, you know. But even the so-called serious films in Hollywood today. What was that one about World War I? What was it called? 1917 or whatever, by what's his name? I can't even remember his name, the director.
Oh, I'm blanking on this one.
Yeah, but even that, you know,
It
that was
wasn't memorable to you or I or me because we don't remember it.
it was a gimmick movie, you know. It was, you know, and so, you know, I have a hard time, you know, even the so-called good movies, even the so-called marquee movies. I mean, I saw Poor Things last night. Oh my God, what a piece of crap. Okay, I mean, I couldn't believe it. You know, we went to the late show. Every once in a while, I like to ask for my money back, you know, but there was nobody at the ticket booth anymore. So I couldn't ask for my money back, you know. It's like Orson Welles said a long time ago that he thought when the actors had a chance to actually make their own pictures, you know, the thing would Hollywood would get better. He said, no, it hasn't, you know. So here you have this Emma Stone, you know, making this this piece of excrement, you know, which evidently she thinks was pretty good. It actually won some Oscars, I think, tonight, you know, which tells you a lot about what's happened to that ceremony. All right.
What
But
was it you hated so much about it, out of curiosity? I haven't had a chance
did
to
you
see
see
it.
it?
I haven't had
You
a
know,
chance to see it
yeah.
yet.
All right, don't, please. Okay. First of all, it was one of the dumbest plots I've ever read. Okay, I've ever seen. All right. And there was nothing in the picture, I believe, that was made you root for one person or the other person over somebody else. You know, because I think they were all pretty weird characters, you know. And Mark Ruffalo, who I my nickname for him is Mr. Nothing, who I've never been able to explain this guy's success, and he was supposed to be the handsome debonair hero opposite Emma Stone. I hate to tell you, Mark, you're never going to let anybody forget Clark Gable. Okay, I didn't see it. It's sort of like a Frank. It's supposed to be a Frankenstein movie. Willem Dafoe plays this crazy scientist, who created this person, this Emma Stone character. Okay, I never believed either one of them. Okay, and so consequently, I was never invested in this story. And as the picture went on and on, it seemed really kind of aimless to me. I don't want to give away the plot. There's only one plot twist in the picture. I guess I shouldn't give. Well, maybe I will anyway. Okay, she is saved by this mad scientist, right? Because she had jumped into a river. All right. And then he goes ahead and transform her by doing a brain operation. And then supposedly she finds the guy who she was married to at the time. Okay. And that's supposed to be the end of the picture. All right. When, except it's an unhappy ending. And it was so unbelievable. Okay. That, I was just more or less, twiddling my thumbs. I really don't like movies in which it's bizarre just to be bizarre. You
Right.
know, there really isn't anything that you can really latch on to, as either a hero or a heroine or a cause, and it just sort of meanders throughout. But I believe that this was meant to be a star vehicle. Okay, that's what it was meant to be. It was supposed to be a star vehicle for her. Okay.
Well, I mean, I think she just won the Academy Award for
Oh
Best
no, she
Actress. She
did?
beat. Yeah, I think she beat Lily Gladstone. I know you weren't a fan of that movie either, The Killers of the Flower
Oh,
Moon,
good. Well,
but.
that's another good example, of I have that reviewed on my Substack article, my Substack site. Okay. After I resigned from Consortium News, I published that review on my Substack site. Now, did you read the book?
I have not read the book. I did enjoy the movie, but maybe, I mean, different
The only
strokes for.
way you can enjoy the movie is you don't read the book.
Okay.
Okay. All right. The Killers of the Flower Moon is a really good book. All right.
Okay.
In a lot of different ways. And very briefly, it's about this giant web of conspiracy that deprives the Osage Indians of their leasing rights to this oil that was found on their territory. All right. And it resulted in several murders, shootings, poisonings, etc., until it was finally solved. All right. The major character in the book, and you've seen the film, right? The major character in the book is a Jesse Plemons character. Okay. He was a guy the FBI sent out, to solve what was happening there. See, and that was the part that was supposed to be Leonardo DiCaprio's part. Well, he didn't want to do that part. He wanted to do the husband. And so to get the picture made and for him to get top billing, that's what they did. Now, Jesse Plemons to me, is, well, he might be one notch above Mark Ruffalo. Okay. But there was no dynamic center to the movie, and there were many things, and if you read my review, you'll see what I mean, that was left out for whatever reason. And if you want to see a lot of Indian rituals, okay, And if you want to see a lot of old Indians passing away, you know, in their blankets, I mean, that's the movie for you. But that's not the book. That wasn't the book at all.
It didn't capture the heart of the book.
No. And I since I don't mind offending people in Hollywood, okay, you know, I blame that, you know, on the combination of Scorsese and DiCaprio, you know, and reportedly they rewrote the script, and then the original backer wouldn't back the movie, okay, you know, and so he had to take it somewhere else. You know, and so, you know, I was very, in fact, to be perfectly frank, I was so disappointed. I saw the movie twice in 2 days. Okay.
Wow,
And if
that's
you're,
a lot of viewing of Killers of the
well, and
it's not a short movie.
it's not just the 6 hours. It's like, you know, movies are not cheap these days. Okay. And so I had to see it twice in 2 days just to reconcile my disappointment because I was really expecting something good. You know, so you know, Oppenheimer won Best Picture, and that they actually deserved it. That actually deserved it. You know, that was a respectable picture. You know, even though I don't like most of his pictures, all
Right.
right. One, I think there's
There were two more things I wanted to cover, but continue
go
what you were
ahead.
going to say. Well, I was going to say you. I had asked you about what Ollie Stone thought, but you were in the middle of describing. You were saying that there are good filmmakers that want to make good movies, but you were sort of implying they can't in modern Hollywood. Can you bounce off that a little bit more? Why do you think there are these good filmmakers that aren't able to get good films made?
Well, in my opinion, there are some people at the production level, you know, that is at the studio level, all right, that do want to get good pictures made, you know, but there's too many of the other kind of people, you know, that essentially block their way. Okay, and I can tell you one thing, a guy named, well, maybe I shouldn't say his name, but he was pitching a movie at one of the studios, okay? And it was about the CIA, okay? And he presented a memo from the CIA in his pitch, okay? And he passed it out to the people at the table. After reading it, one of the guys says, "I wrote this." So, in other words, you have a CIA guy, you know, actually sitting, you know, at one of these things. And there's that book, The CIA in Hollywood.
Yeah, we did a whole episode on this a few
Oh,
years
you
ago.
did?
Yeah. No, I
Okay.
did it with you.
Oh, you did it with me? Okay. All right. Okay, there's that whole book, and then there's the other book about the Pentagon in Hollywood.
That's a very
Okay,
good book. Yeah, I
yeah,
think it's David Robb wrote it. Yeah.
he passed away rather recently, David Robb. Okay, he was one of the best entertainment writers that there was, you know, about the movie business. Well, if you take a look at those two books, you'll see why it's not easy to get pictures made in Hollywood. All
Right.
right. Okay, and because you have, and that's just dealing with the institutional thing about the CIA and the Pentagon, you know, but there's also the whole money mad kind of thing, you know, what's going to be the audience for this? Can, you know, and how long is the movie, you know,
Yeah, I was going to
and
say, I think Hollywood has become risk averse when it comes to. Maybe not, they're not risk averse with the big gigantic budgets, but they're risk averse with making
Right.
challenging movies for grown-ups. Like they're risk averse about the content of the movie, you know.
See, David Lean, if you take a look at the AFI honoring of David Lean, you know, when he was allowed to speak at the end, you know, he read a memo from one of the studio chiefs, which I guess he keeps in his sport coat. You know? And in that letter, it closed with his consideration of a kind of odd movie. He goes, look, the studio can afford to lose a little money this year. Okay. And David Lean closed with that. And he said, there's not enough of these people around anymore that feel that way, that we can afford to lose a little money, you know, this year, you know. And let me bring this up. See, you used to have room enough for a movie like Five Easy Pieces to be a hit. It got into enough theaters, okay? It created a buzz, okay? And it made money, all right? And by the way, at that time, Jack Nicholson was not a real big star, okay, like he is today or was today. Okay, he's retired now, okay? But that created enough buzz because it was so different, you know, that it became both a commercial hit and a critical hit, and ended up getting nominated for 5 Academy Awards, you know? You know, when's the last time you saw something like that? You know? There isn't. You don't. And this French film, did you see it, Anatomy of a Fall?
No, I haven't.
All right, stay home for that one, too. Okay. Yeah. I mean, that is supposed to be our version of a classy, you know, foreign picture, you know, and all I can say is, excuse me, I'll take 8.5 any day of the week, you know, over something like that, you know. So I you know, I guess it's getting kind of glum, you know.
Well, but before we close out, the last thing I wanted to touch upon was, see, I had a weird trajectory with film because I grew up and I liked, you know, a lot of big, dumb movies. Golden Globus produced Charles Bronson movies were like a guilty pleasure for me as a teenager, you know, and that stuff is fun and whatnot at times. But I feel like now with the democratization of film criticism, you have people that will say, well, I just like these diehard movies and these Terminator movies, and they refuse to even look back at the past of cinema. And they're not going to watch a Pasolini movie. They're not going to watch an Antonioni movie. They'll look at you and say, oh, that's all that highfalutin, art house, highbrow, elitist stuff, you know, and they act like they're the populists. And they treat older film critics and the bygone era of film criticism as just being this elitist exercise against the populist masses that want their diehard sequels. And I think that's wrongheaded. I don't like the accusation that film critics of the past are just elitists. I think we can learn a lot from listening to film critics, and I think we can learn a lot from watching movies outside of, you know, the big budget blockbusters. I'm not saying the big budget blockbusters don't have their place, but, you know, I think I feel like I would not be as good with my cinematic education if I hadn't, you know, watched movies like Antonioni's Blow Up in college. I really feel like I wouldn't have had literacy in cinema if I didn't. So I feel like people really do need to consider, you know, looking at these films that were challenging for their time and looking for films that are challenging now, although they're few and far between. That's my view. What's yours at the end of the analysis with regards to some of those issues?
Let me put that in a nutshell. As Robert Brustein, critiqued theater and film. He said what he learned is that it's not the function of the director to bring Tolstoy to the masses. It was the function of the director to bring the masses to Tolstoy. Okay? It was the other way around. It was to educate. It was to challenge, you know, it was to be provocative in a good way. It was literally what that word means, is to make you think. That's what his job was. Okay. It wasn't to homogenize and pasteurize, you know, to make it digestible so you can have it for breakfast. And
Okay. that's what the best film critics did, in my view. You know, whereas everyone else may be talking about some big summer movie, a good film critic would say, well, what about this movie that, you know, is being ignored because it's not, you know, the big blockbuster of the summer? And, you know, they drew attention to movies that maybe otherwise wouldn't have, you know, gotten as much attention. And I feel like that's the importance of film criticism.
Before Terrence Malick essentially blew his career, okay, he made a really interesting picture, which I hope everybody on this, listening to this, you know, can take a look at. It was called Badlands, all right, with Martin Sheen and Sissy Spacek
That's
before they
based on
became
that shooter, right?
the Starkweather Fugate Killers, all right. If you haven't seen it, you really should see it because there was a real attempt, okay, in that picture by a very intelligent guy. I think Malick went to Harvard, okay, to make a work of art through film out of a very unappealing and controversial subject, okay. And if you take a look at that picture, you'll see how a really intelligent director can make out of images something that really makes you ponder and think about the experience that you just had. All right. In fact, in my movie viewing days, and maybe people don't believe me, but I was a movie viewer back in the 70s. Okay. As far back as that. They let me do a two-part review of that because I thought that that was such an interesting. It wasn't just the subject matter. In fact, the subject matter was essentially about a serial killer. Okay. You know, but it was the way he approached the material, the way he shot the picture, you know, that I thought was so memorable and was so striking. And I tried to deal with that in my review. All right. I think that's 75 or 76 or something like that. But if you can see that on YouTube, okay. See, I think Malick's career has become more like a, you know, like the guy goes to a lot of paintings and he tries to imitate paintings on films. Okay. Whereas in that film, you know, he really was interested in cinema and how I can, you know, make editing, music, photography. And the shot, you know, to make it be above the material that I'm addressing. You know, so at the end of that movie, when that wonderful sequence at the airport, okay, if you analyze that sequence, okay, you'll see. Let me use another example, because I think more people have seen this film.
Although
And
I will
Lauren,
say people should see Badlands. That is an
yeah,
incredible
that's
movie.
good. I'm really glad you agree with me, you know. In Lawrence of Arabia, if you recall, at the end of the movie, Lawrence figures out that he's a failure. He goes to this hospital that doesn't even have any running water to it, and all these people are just laying around in agony with no nurses and, you know, nothing there. And you see him trying to put water in a pail, okay, and this officer comes over, you know, and slugs him, you know. The next shot in that sequence is a reflection of Lawrence off the table, you know, in this conference room. All right. And Peter O'Toole's in the background. These guys are talking about his future. Alec Guinness and Jack Hawkins and Claude Rains. And he's in chiaroscuro, okay, which means he's half light, half dark. And he really doesn't have any much to say, except they promote him. They tell him they're promoting him. And he says, why? Okay. All right. So you get the feeling, which is capitalized on as he's dismissed and he walks out of the room, and there's these white curtains that he walks through, and they built, so you get the feeling that he's a ghost. Okay. And that's the whole point, you know, of the picture. And then they both say when he's gone, we're glad to be rid of him. And then the next scene is you see him driving in the desert, okay, and the guy goes to him, going home, sir. And he doesn't say anything. Okay. The whole theme of the picture is capitalized there, where he's become, like a kind of walking dead. He's been eaten up and spit out by these superiors, and there's really nothing left to him except that he knows he has a few years left to live. And that's beautifully done. That's what you don't get.
Right.
That's what you don't get in any movies anymore. You don't get that a level of intellectual and aesthetic stimulation. How the hell could you make a Lawrence of Arabia today?
Right. Well, I think that the producers would say, "Oh, that's not on the nose enough," and they would want you to spell it out for them, right? Real quick, Jim, with regards to what I said earlier about, I think a lot of people are going to listen to this and say, "Oh,
What?
that no." Well, people, I know there's going to be at least one person that gives me hate mail and says, "Oh, you guys are being fuddy-duddy film critics, and you're so elitist, and you don't like the populist masses." How do you respond to the people that just think film critics are elitist and anti-populist? I just wanted to ask you that.
Look, the reason that me and you are having this conversation, I believe, is that at one time, a while ago, I really loved pictures. I really loved going to the movies. I really wanted to see the next thing coming down the pike. Okay. Because I really thought that, hey, this is going to be a really interesting experience. Okay. This is going to be something that's going to be challenging. And film now, for a few years back then, you got the feeling that film was really going to transfer itself, to the next level. All right. That it was going to be a part of America, the transferring consciousness, raising the consciousness of all those people going to the movie. Well, that didn't happen, for a lot of different reasons. Okay. It's not that I'm an elitist. It's not that I'm looking down at the masses. It's that I'm trying to find a way to make the people understand what a lost opportunity the cinema really was. Okay. What was that piece of crap movie, The Black Phone or whatever, with Ethan Hawke?
Ethan
Okay.
Hawke. Yes, I saw that a while back.
I mean, if that's all we have to offer the public, okay, then I'd sort of like close up shop and go home. If I couldn't do any better than that, I would really be, wondering, maybe I should be in a different business,
What for you is the golden age? Is it, would you say like 66 to 74, or when do you think?
Yeah, it's 1964 to about 1975, and I guess the bracket on that would be Dr. Strangelove and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Right.
Okay, which, by the way, were both hits. Those movies were both hits. Okay, so please don't tell me that I'm elitist. Okay, all those movies, Dr. Strangelove, Bonnie and Clyde, The Graduate, The Wild Bunch, Midnight Cowboy, okay, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Blow Up. Those were all hits. Those all made money, So don't tell me it's not possible, and don't tell me an elitist. I'm not an elitist. All right. Okay. There was one time in this country, from those 11 or 12 years, that, oh my God, JG, how could we forget Chinatown?
Right.
Okay, oh my God, I'm sick. I can't believe I left that out. Okay. Chinatown. If you, and if you haven't seen that, you're not alive. Okay. You will not ever see a better film noir, okay, than Chinatown. Okay. Or what I believe Coppola's best picture, The Conversation.
The
Okay.
conversation is brilliant. I mean, we're never going to get an era like that again where we had all these really just brilliant paranoid thrillers, like the Parallax View, which
And we
namesake of
left
this
out the
show.
parallax view.
Well, even
Okay,
all of
there's
those,
also the,
Clute, you know, the entire
yeah.
trilogy. Yeah.
I mean, the conversation, I mean, that is, there's a sequence in the conversation where he dis it's a the great discovery moment, which is in complete silence. There isn't a sound on the soundtrack. Okay. You know, and he's walking through this empty apartment where he knows something has happened, but he's not sure what it was. And there's this feeling of dread as he walks in, pulls the curtain on the shower, looks around the room, and I don't want to give it away, but I'll just say this: with one flush of the toilet, the whole mystery explodes in your face. Okay. Now tell me where you've had a moment like that recently, you know, in the movies. But then that's topped later when he discovers that what he was thinking was the exact opposite of what the truth is. Okay. You know, and so you don't, you won't see that in an American, or to describe the last 5 minutes of Chinatown. Okay. What goes on in those last 5 minutes of Chinatown? Okay, which is that movie has the, I don't think I've ever seen a moment where the triumph of evil is so incandescent, you know, so forceful, you know, in this avuncular figure of John Huston, okay, at the end of that picture, you know, where the good gets forced out, you know, and evil is absolutely rising, you know, and see, you don't see that in pictures anymore. You don't see anything like those moments in pictures anymore, you know. And so I don't consider myself an elitist. Chinatown was a big hit. Okay. You know, Chinatown got nominated for like 11 Academy Awards, you know, and, you know, and, you know, and if you haven't seen the Parallax View, oh my God, you know, that's a truly, you know, the Parallax View is sort of like a summary, and I don't think I'm exaggerating very much, maybe just a little. In an entertainment thriller picture, he sums up what happened to America.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it's interesting because so many people view it as just being about the assassinations of the 60s, but really,
No.
in a weird way, that movie is about the assassination of America and the American
Right.
dream. Yeah,
Right.
which
And
is what makes it so
the
brilliant.
last scene of that movie,
It's horrifying.
okay, when they pronounced the verdict, you know, about what happened to the Warren Beatty character, and it echoes the beginning of the movie, okay, there will be no questions. All right. And it goes to black. Okay. This is what happened to the guy. Good night. Okay.
I think you're, by the way, I think you're onto something. I know we'll wrap up here, but I think you're onto something when you say you're not being elitist about it, because a lot of the same people that will say, oh, you're too hard on the Marvel and the DC movies, which I maintain I'm not. I just want other types of movies other than that to exist and to be shown in theaters. But those same people will yell at me about liking Oliver Stone movies. And what they'll say to me is, they'll say, oh, that Oliver Stone, he always beats you over the head with his message. And I don't think he does that. I think he's just a really good communicator and he wants to communicate ideas to the movie viewer. I don't think he's beating you over the head with anything, but.
Beating you over the head? I mean, geez, how can you beat anybody over the head about Vietnam? Okay.
Right.
That was the worst American disaster, you know, in probably, yeah, 100 years. Okay. I mean, come on. I mean, if you weren't around, you should really read about it. It was absolutely the worst American foreign, the only thing that rivals it is the invasion of Iraq. Okay. But I think Vietnam was actually worse. Okay. Where you had the whole collapse of Indochina, the death of something like, and by the way, would you, it was Vietnam that caused the rise of Pol Pot in Cambodia. Okay. So how can you beat anybody over the head about that? I mean, it really, really was that awful. You know, and I believe the assassination of President Kennedy was that awful. Okay, I mean, when you can something that's so obviously a conspiracy and you can cover that up, that's where the parallax view comes in. Okay, you know, there'll be no more questions.
Well, let's see, even a movie like, I've never understood when people tell me Ollie beats the viewer over the head, because I don't know how anyone can watch a movie like Nixon and say he's beating you over the head with a message, because that movie is much more complex in its
Yeah.
portrayal of Nixon than it had any right to be in a lot of ways. It's a
The
brilliant
only thing
film.
that the only thing I hold, and I actually told him this once, I go, you know, that was pretty sympathetic, okay, to a guy who is you know, and he turned on me and he said, it's not sympathetic, it's empathic.
That's how I described the film to someone, actually. So I'm glad. But yeah, I mean,
I mean, come on, I mean, empathic to somebody like Nixon, okay. You know, but no, but Nixon is a very intelligent movie. You know, it's, I don't think it's that beats anybody over the head. You know, I give him credit for making a movie like that. You know,
yeah.
but you know, see, Oliver has gotten this reputation. You know, because and one of the reasons I think he has gotten that reputation is that he's the only guy out there doing this. You
Right.
know. That this would not be the case in the 1970s or 60s. Okay, but right now, he's the only guy out there, you know, who's against, you know, the establishment, you know, and really trying to do something about it.
Well, it's no one today is going to make a movie like Wall Street or JFK or Nixon, or it's just, it's unheard of to do those type of films.
Yeah, and he was lucky there for a while because he, those got a lot of Oscars and they made money, you know. And then of course the world turned on him when he did JFK, you know, because that was just too radioactive. But he still managed to do Nixon afterwards. You know,
And
so you
any
know,
given Sunday, yeah.
I mean, I give the guy a lot of credit. You know, you know, it's it, he said when I actually met him for the first time down in his office, he was in Santa Monica then. You know, and we were talking, and he said words of the effect, you know, I used to be able to get anything through. Okay. Yeah. But now it's really, really difficult. And some I can't get through. And I said, well, what happened? And he goes, well, Jim, my reputation, you know. That's what happened. And that's
I
what.
don't think people know, like, the reviews against JFK were brutal. I mean, I've looked up some of those reviews. They were freaking out. Like, it was like there were critics calling it like a Death of America moment, because they're like, he's promoting fusionist paranoia that will, tie together the far right and the far left in this. They were like really acting like Oliver Stone was going to destroy democracy. I remember I can pick up the reviews from like the New York Times and stuff. It was ridiculous. And I mean, it really was a blow. I mean, they attacked him hard.
It was some of them, and by the way, this went on for a year. Because they started attacking the film 7 months before it came out. And then it went all the way to the Oscars. Because they didn't want it to win any Oscars. I don't know if you know this, probably very few people do. David Belin, who was on the Warren Commission, wrote an anonymous letter to Variety magazine, and he did it under a pseudonym, pleading, "Don't let this win Best Picture." Okay, that's how determined they were. All right, and that's what he was up against. You know, so you know, I give Oliver a lot of credit for putting up the good fight.
Well, I guess we'll close on that note. Is there anything you want to plug before we close up shop here? And what did you want to say in closing, if there's any final words?
Please don't call me an elitist. and don't call JG an elitist. We're not elitist. We just want to see film really fulfill itself, you know, as an institution, as an art form. You know, it's okay, fine. Go ahead and make as many Black Panther movies as you want. Go ahead and make as many Batman movies as you want. But don't forget the small niche pictures, you know, because they really do belong there. You know, and every once in a while, they have a very strong impact that you can't equal with 10 Batmans. Okay, so that's a message I'd like to leave your audience with before I get splattered with pies.
And anything new at Kennedy's and King?
Oh, yeah, I guess I should talk a little bit about that to promote myself. Kennedysandking.com is my website where you get the most current materials on the JFK case and the RFK case, the Malcolm X case, and the King case. All right. And you'll see reviews and articles there, which you won't see anyplace else. My latest book is something called The JFK Assassination Chokeholds. And that's an anthology which I'm a contributor to. All right. And I guess in signing off, so I don't come off as like a, I don't know what I'm talking about. I was a screenwriter for JFK Revisited and JFK Destiny Betrayed, which, by the way, and I want to close with this. The DVD came out over a year ago, over 1 year ago of JFK Revisited. In fact, it's closer to a year and a half. It is still in the top 10 of Amazon documentaries. As of yesterday, it was number 5.
Wow.
Okay. And so when people say there isn't a market, there isn't a hunger for these kinds of films, I'm sorry. There's the proof right there. There is.
Right. Thank you again, Jim, for coming on Parallax Views.
Thank you for having me.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I should be back on track and releasing more episodes this month, so be on the lookout for that. I really need the support on Patreon to keep this going, though. So if you can support me at patreon.com/parallaxviews, I will definitely be making up for the lack of content last month. Just give me a chance to recalibrate. Got a few episodes coming up in the next few days, so please head on over to patreon.com/parallaxviews if you appreciate the work I do here. And with that being said,
until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.